mics are open, and we're going to start with implementation matters, and Vincent is going to help.
Thank you. Good morning to everybody. We'll start today's discussion with Agenda Paper 12A that discusses the transition, effective date, and due process for the amendments to IS 16 on proceeds before intended use. Paragraph 18 to 15 of the paper provide our analysis and recommendation with respect to the transition requirements for entities already applying IFRS standards. Paragraph 16 to 19 include our analysis and recommendation regarding transition requirement for first-time adopters. We recommend that the board confirm the transition requirement proposed in the exposure draft for entities already applying IFRS standards and provide no specific transition relief for first-time adopters of IFRS standards. Therefore, we recommend that all entities apply amendments retrospectively only to items of property, plant and equipment made available for use after the beginning of the earliest period presented. I will now direct your attention to questions 1 and 2 on page 7 of the paper and ask whether you agree with our recommendations.
Thank you. I agree with staff's proposal. I think it will provide a great relief for the preparers. I just have one comment on the wording. Current word, I think the intention of existing wording is try to be narrow in the scope, which retrospective application will apply. That means those items of PPE were made available for use before the beginning of the earliest period will not apply this retrospective application. But when I read the wording, it seems that not sufficiently clear, because currently we say we require entity to apply the amendment retrospectively only to items of PPE made available for use on or after the beginning of the earliest period. Some people may say, okay, those items, PPE, made available for use on the beginning of the earliest period may still including those items of PPE were available for use before the earliest period. So I would like to suggest that whether can add some word, for example, will only apply for to the items of PPE start to be made available for use on or after the beginning of the earliest period to make it more clear, you know, clearer than existing wording. Secondly, I compare this word and agenda paper what maybe C 12C about in the earliest period. I would suggest that can we make it clear that that is the earliest annual reporting period. Mm-hmm. So that means not the earliest interim, you know, reporting period. Mm-hmm. That is the annual period. Very important. Yeah. So just two comments to the suggest, to the proposal.
Tudor.
Thank you. So, in relation to the transition for those companies that are already applying IFRS, I can understand that the retrospective application for those assets that are under construction would bring some consistency for the income statement. But usually, because these are material assets, companies that are already operating this segment in the balance sheet wouldn't. I don't think that we have many benefits from having this applied retrospectively, even if it is just limited to those assets that are under construction. I honestly don't see reason for not allowing these companies to apply this concept prospectively, because they will get the income statement comparability And at the same time, I don't think that it will be a big deal for the balance sheet. And it might bring some burden for them trying to, especially if they have a project that is 7-8 years ongoing, for mining companies especially. I think that, honestly, I don't think that is a big advantage of applying retrospectively also, even for assets under construction. This is for those applying IFRS. And for first-time adopters...
Can I, if it's helpful, Tadu, I just want to clarify, I think, what you're suggesting there, if it's helpful, because you use the word prospectively, but I think, just to understand what you're saying or suggesting is, I think what you're suggesting is the prospective in the context of the proceeds. So I think you're not suggesting what some respondents suggested when they suggested prospective, which is kind of, you know, delaying and only having the amendments apply to sort of items of PP&E that almost begin their construction. I think what you're suggesting is meaning that you would apply this to any seals that happen from the beginning of the earliest comparative period.
That's correct.
Isn't that right? Yeah. I think that's an important clarification.
Is the beginning of the earliest period presented?
But it proceeds not available for use is what you're saying.
No, proceeds.
Yes.
And even if inventory, yeah. Because you may generate some inventory and then you have this in your balance sheet. You haven't the proceeds yet. I mean, but you would start accumulating this cost as inventory since the beginning of the earliest period presented.
Well, the difference would be just that, sorry. You wouldn't be making an adjustment to opening sort of retained earnings for proceeds in earlier periods for those things.
You wouldn't.
That would be the difference
yeah.
between. Mary?
I have one. I don't know whether we can divide this one. But for first-time adopters, I know that's not good just feeding more and more exceptions, exemptions, et cetera, in IFRS 1. But when we talk about assets and liabilities that are very long period in the balance sheet, that's what makes first-time adopter lives more difficult. And then I'm really sympathetic for companies who are applying IFRS for the first time. They already have some options available for borrowing costs, capitalization, decommissioning, something that you know that if you have to go back and rebuild it, it will take a long time. And then for this company, they would rest with just one solution that is deemed cost. I don't know why we can't provide for the first-time adopter the same exemption, the same transition requirement that we are applying for those that are applying IFRS currently. I would provide the same.
Mary?
I'm reacting to Tadeo's first suggestion about saying the amendment applies to prospectively from the beginning of the earliest comparative period to any proceeds after that date rather than to assets available for use after that date. On the one hand, it's clear we're making a change as opposed to a clarification because the standard now says net of proceeds and we're saying no longer net of proceeds. So it is a change rather than just a, you know, trying to resolve diversity. But it does concern me that we are moving away from retrospective applications. So I think if we were to I hesitate to make that change kind of on the fly. That I'm not convinced yet.
Well, the real difference is the information for investors. So do we have strong feelings on that front in terms of the feedback we've got?
So I think as the feedback suggested by by the way, we had very little commentary in comment letters, even on transition requirements at all. And we did speak to investors about the proposals more broadly, but I'm not sure we had any specific views
on transition
for investors.
I share Mary's reservations in terms of doing this right now. It's not so much about the proceeds being recognised through the P&L. It's the longer-lasting impact on those balance sheet values and resulting in reduced depreciation level for many years ahead. So by pushing back any adjustments to those values seems to will diminish the value of the information to investors. It's not really about the proceeds. It's about getting that asset value on a consistent basis. And that has an impact for many years.
I think we should see if we've got enough support.
Just make a point that we already will have some inconsistency balance sheet, because I'm doing this for assets that are under construction at the date of transition. But I also had assets that might have finished the year before.
Yeah.
I mean, the inconsistency is already there. And again, what I'm sympathetic with this industry, especially the mining one, that sometimes they have 10 years project to get a mine ready. It's a huge work going back and trying to track all the proceeds. That's what I'm trying to say, that I fully agree that it brings some inconsistency and it will have some effect in depreciation in the future. But I also have the effect for the projects before.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what we are trying, if you just do it prospectively, we will get the consistency in terms of income statement, but we still get some inconsistency in terms of the depreciation, but we already have that one. But
so if we had full retrospective, just traditional retrospective, then we'd remove the inconsistency. What the staff proposes has some inconsistency because of stuff that was completed before the comparative period, but less inconsistency than what Tadal's suggesting. So I think there's a spectrum of inconsistency. And your recommendation is sort of at one level.
We're balancing.
Mary?
I think one other thing we have to remember is that the point that is a clarification that these amendments will make is that ready for use is operational only, not financial and operational. So in some ways, if we took the proceeds, proceeds after date X approach, we could, in effect, allow people to continue using the financial and operating for a period of time for anything that's out there. So we'd, I think, have to at least split the decision about the impact of that, and that starts to get a little complicated.
Yeah, let's see if we can support the steps or recommendation on transition.
Question one.
Question one.
2, 3, 4, 13. 5, 6.
No.
I'm sorry, 12, one absent. Yeah.
Question two. Can we vote on that one now? Or?
Yes.
Yes? Question two.
First time adopters.
11, one absent. I congratulate Tadeu with his first dissent.
Yeah. I'm feeling well.
That's important. That's an important moment.
Hopefully not that
you show your principles.
Hopefully not an actual dissent, just a disagreement.
No, it's not the case.
We'll see soon.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, so look at paragraph 20 to 27 of the paper, which discuss the effective date for the amendments. We recommend the board require entities to apply the amendments to annual periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2022, with earlier application permitted. I will now direct your attention to question 3 on page 9 of the paper and ask whether you agree with this recommendation.
One absent.
Okay.
Um, paragraph now, if we look at paragraphs 28 to 36 of the paper, which discuss due process steps, I will now direct your attention to question 4 to 6 on page 11 of the paper. I will first ask you whether you agree with our recommendation not to re-expose the amendment to IS-16.
Can I see? We do.
Yep, 13, one absent.
I will now, in accordance with paragraph 6.23 of the due process handbook, I will now ask whether any board member intends to dissent from the issuance of the amendments to IS-16.
Okay, here's your real opportunity.
I'm skipping that one.
No dissents.
Yeah.
And lastly, I will ask whether you are satisfied that the board has complied with the applicable due process requirements and that it has undertaken sufficient consultation and analysis to begin the balloting process for the amendments to IS-16.
13, one absent.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Vincent. Go to Craig. Owner's contract.
Good morning. Agenda papers 12B to D are by the owner's contracts, cost of fulfilling a contract. So in the exposure draft, the board proposed to amend IS-37 to specify that the cost of fulfilling a contract for the purpose of assessing where the contractor's owner is. Last month, the board decided to proceed with the project and specify that the cost of fulfilling a contract comprise the costs that relate directly to the contract. The purpose of agenda papers 12B to D is to provide the board with analysis of comments on the examples proposed in the exposure draft and other comments received. Agenda paper 12B provides the board with background information about the project, and it contains no questions for the board. Moving on to agenda paper 12C, this provides the board with an analysis of comments on the examples in the exposure draft. Paragraphs 7 to 20 of Agenda Paper 12C include a summary of the comment. Respondents generally supported the board's proposal to clarify which costs relate directly to a contract. The comments indicate there are two ways the board could provide this clarification. It could do so through examples, as proposed in the exposure draft, and this is discussed in paragraphs 23 and 24. Alternatively, the board could replace or reinforce the examples with a description of the two types of costs that relate directly to a contract. And this is discussed in paragraphs 25 to 27. We recommend that the board replace the examples proposed in the exposure draft with a clarification that the costs that relate directly to the contract consist of the incremental cost of fulfilling the contract, and an allocation of costs that relate directly to fulfilling that and other contracts. In paragraph 26, we illustrate how this could be drafted. Does the board agree with this recommendation?
Yes, I do think it would be much better than the specific examples.
Mary?
I also do, much as I would love, just for the sake of tidiness, to resolve the difference that you've highlighted between IS-2 and IFRS-15. I think I want to take the opportunity to make a comment here that, as I thought about if we were to go one way versus the other, which way might we go, I think we would be wiser to go IFRS-15, because this is about onerous contracts, and I think the presence of a contract is kind of defining characteristic, and we have contracts in 15 and we have contracts here. We don't have contracts in IS-2 because that's when you're making it for yourself before you have the contract to sell it. So I think that IFRS-15 probably is the more logical reference point. And perhaps I'd just say, to the extent we include any examples, I'm not asking us to, but to the extent you conclude that we should consider that. I would use examples that are consistent with 15. Maybe they could be consistent with both because there are only some small areas of difference around the margins, but I would not fall on the side of eyes to.
Chen Chao.
Yes, I agree with staff's proposal. I think its current proposal is better than the exposure draft's proposal because if we look at paragraph 6, the exposure draft proposal, it looks a little bit strange because we're using the examples of cost. And then we're using additional examples to illustrate those examples. It causes a lot of confusion. For example, direct labor. And then we're using salaries and wages to, as an example to illustrate what's the meaning of the direct labor. And then many people ask a question, what's the relation between those salaries and wages with employees' benefits, whether pension costs should also be included. So I prefer current proposal that is we should build on the principles first and give some additional example to illustrate those principles. And this kind of approach could apply not only for the contractor to provide goods and services, but also can apply to the contractor to purchase goods and services. So I think it's really much, much better than the exposure draft proposal. So I agree with the staff's proposal.
Tom?
Just a quick question. Did you contemplate, I really like the new paragraph 28. Did you contemplate, like you could have kept some example to go with it. Did you contemplate that at all and just maybe elaborate for me a little bit why you thought it was better to cleanse it completely?
So I think in the paragraph, is it 26?
Paragraph 26, yes.
We did include one example of each type. So we tried to use the overall principle and having the two different types of costs. Then afterwards, when we see incremental costs, we have, for example, direct labor materials, which I think we brought forward from the exposure draft, and then the allocation of costs. After that bullet point, we do see, for example, an allocation of depreciation on an item of PP&E, which I think was also one of the examples that was in the exposure draft.
So basically what we're recommending is kind of exactly what you were suggesting there, Tom, is that we're going to try and sort of spell out that cost that relate directly involve these two categories of costs, but then also include a for example beside each that picks up a number of the examples that were already proposed.
Thank you. I agree with your step recommendation much better than before. But based on this new principle-based approach, it might create some kind of diversity in practice in future. So I guess so. Your suggestion here, the clarification you are going to add, this might be very important. So there are many examples of that cost directly related to fulfilling contract. So based on you need to be very careful in suggesting some examples that must be directly related to this country. So that kind of a clear clarification might be very important. Thank you.
Rika.
Thank you. I'm kind of echo what Aza said. I think I support the current staff's recommendation to make it simpler. And also, I think it's clearly important clarification about what the cost of fulfilling that contract means, because it's quite different from the what stated in IS 11. At that time, it said the cost that relate directly to the specific contract, and now we said the cost to fulfilling the contract, that should not be the same. So I think it's really helpful for explaining how to use this new terminology in practice.
Ms. Plaza.
I also agree with the staff recommendation, and I agree that we have examples, and I would just recommend that the examples that we select provide a basis for avoiding the ambiguity so that we don't make, you know, produce very simple examples, but more examples that really help dissipate whatever questions would remain.
Okay. So can we support the staff's recommendation?
13, one absent.
Okay, so we move on to agenda paper 12D. This analyzes comments on matters other than those on which the board specifically invited comments on. And these comments cover three areas. I'm going to go through each of these in turn. The first area that the paper discusses is the scope of the project. Some respondents suggested the board add other aspects of the onerous contract requirements to the scope of the project. Suggestions include what is meant by the term economic benefits, how an entity measures an onerous contract provision, and combining or segmenting contracts. A recommendation in paragraph 15 of the paper is that the board does not expand the scope of this project to address these matters. Do you agree with this recommendation?
I think we do. Oh, Tom.
Just had a comment. I'm in favor, but I have a bit of concern with paragraph 34. So I definitely agree with retrospective because I think it would require hindsight. And I think
not there yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Always ahead of us, Tom. Sorry.
Just a confirmation of my understanding. Because of the change in the definition of the unavoidable cost for some stakeholders, believe the unavoidable cost is an incremental cost. In such a case, I think that the accounting implication might have two ways. One is the timing of recognition of a liability, and another is kind of the measurement of that liability for onerous contract. So I do not think it is necessary to explain something in the main text, but I'm just wondering if some kind of the indication of the, such consideration included in BC or somewhere to give some flag up the people who might be affected by that consideration to apply this new amendment. Is that possible or?
I think, I mean, maybe we can talk, because in the BC of the, sorry, in the basis for conclusions, I should say, of the exposure draft.
Yes.
There was already a bit of discussion around measurement in that respect. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I thought that maybe that might cover it, but I don't know whether you have thoughts that we need to go further.
Yeah. It's
because I think the message is still that our change in the requirements is very much just to do with, you know, cost of fulfilling a contract. We're not changing the measurement requirements, but
not changing.
Some commentary on what that might mean for measurement.
I understand that, yes.
Martin?
My example from last month, because I think it is a kind of, we're doing this project and we're making the right decisions for construction contracts. I totally agree with that, but my example with a building and we have 10 flats, I think that will not be an economic good outcome, because if you don't have this additional contract for this empty flat, then you don't have anything in the P&L and balance sheet. If you're doing the contract, which is beneficial because you're getting some cash, maybe not is covering the direct cost, then you have to recognize an onerous contract and showing a loss. And I think that is not an economic good outcome, and therefore I also don't agree with that, because I think it falls a little bit too short, because we're making the right decision for some contracts but not for other contracts. That is why I'm not in favor of that, not discussing that. Because it has to do with beneficial, because it is a kind of getting a little bit more is better in some times than nothing. And therefore, I think that is my point. But I raised it
still a good argument.
what about implement?
Yeah. And I think hopefully.
Sounds convincing to me.
That's because I have not convinced people.
Hans, when you the draft, you know, ultimately, if the board decides to move forward with this, we plan to fully explain this point. I think it'll be important when we explain the board's decision making. You know, in terms of why the board.
We have done it last month, yeah. But I still think it's.
Martin agrees that overall, this amendment, we still think, even in those situations, it's provides in useful information.
Françoise?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard Martin's argument, but I think the impairment would kick in one way or another. So it's not the end of the story.
All right, can we agree with the staff's recommendation?
One.
Question one.
12 went up.
All right, we'll move on.
Okay, so the second topic discussed in this paper is comments about the interaction between the proposed requirements and impairment. In particular, respondents asked how the proposal would interact with paragraph 69 of IS 37. That paragraph requires an entity to recognise any impairment loss that is incurred in assets dedicated to a contract before establishing a provision for the owner's contract. As noted in paragraph 27 of the paper, we recommend changing paragraph 69 of IS 37 to refer to assets that relate directly to a contract rather than assets that are dedicated to a contract. Do you agree with her recommendation?
Mary?
I do agree with making this clarification. I'm not sure that I want to make it now. I'm not throwing a due process type of comment. I just, with IS 37, I am particularly sensitive to unintended consequences. You know, and in this instance, because we have what is, I think, currently a research project on IS 37 on the agenda, I just wonder whether it would be better to say this was noted and we're planning to wrap it into that other project rather than go ahead and do it now. I think we can, and I think it's, you know, I think we could. I think it's consistent with our understanding and intent, but IS 37 just seems to always throw out unintended consequences, so I'm just being cautious. Because we have that other opportunity, I wouldn't hold it if we didn't.
Okay.
I understand Mary's concern, but still, I agree with the staff's proposal because the terms are dedicated to sound like that PPE is only used for a specific contract, not used for multiple contracts. So I think under the current definition of the unavoidable cost, PPE is supposed to use for multiple purposes, possibly. So that part should be highlighted.
Gary.
Thank you. With respect to the staff's recommendation, I think this is a subtle, but it's a very good change. To me, the word dedicated means it's doing nothing but work on this contract, whereas you go back to the prior paper, it's talking about an allocation of depreciation. The use in the contract. And I think dedicated to me excludes everything other than something that's 100% dedicated, when in fact, you know, companies, most assets used for multiple purposes, and it should get its fair share, if you will, of that asset's use in there. So I think it's an important change. I think it's a good change.
Yes, Sue?
I agree with the change that you recommend making, but I have to say I got a bit confused when I read paragraphs 20 to 23. So does this mean that we think that if you look at another standard for impairment that you don't have to look at 36 for impairment as well?
I think what we're trying to say is that paragraph 69 refers to IS 36 because it's the main one that talks about impairment, and that the assets that are excluded from the scope of IS 36, which are the ones that respondents mostly asked about, I think they're excluded because their measurement already includes some element of decreases in the cost.
Okay. Right.
And so you pick it up through the measurement process of those assets rather than an impairment part.
Right. So basically we think that it was referenced because it's the most common but
yeah.
It's subject to the scope exclusion, so you should have read that first.
Yeah.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation? Question two.
12, one absent.
And the last area of comments in agenda paper 12D relate to the board's proposed transition requirements. Paragraph 44 of the paper includes our recommendation. We propose continuing as proposed in the exposure draft, except to clarify that an entity applies the proposed requirements to contracts for which the entity has not yet fulfilled all its obligations under the contract when it first applies the amendments. Do you agree with our recommendation?
Tom.
Yeah, I agree with the recommendation. I think it would involve hindsight. I think it would be costly. This goes a little bit to how you write it up at the end. I think with respect to paragraph 34, if I think about this, depending on how narrowly you define contracts, you get kind of a unit of account. You could be looking at a lot of contracts. And in that world, I think the incidence of the number of impairments, you could have a trend, and that could be actually quite useful information. So that you could have, you know, many, many impairments in 1 year, and then it falls and it rises. That could be correlated with any number of things. So I just thought that was a bit too strong to dismiss the fact, because I think if there's potentially a lot of impairments, the trend and the incidence could be valuable information. That said, I still wouldn't disagree with your recommendation, but I think we just should write it carefully.
Sue?
I agree with your recommendation. The only comment I wanted to make was when I read paragraph 35, I can understand why people get upset with us and with transition. So really flagging to Neely, I think, that this really flags to me that we need to really think about what we do on transition, because it's complicated enough, and if we've got so many variants, it's just really difficult for people. Is it really every situation is so special?
Yeah. I think it's almost because we think about every situation very thoroughly that almost where we end up designing transition.
A candidate for reducing complexity.
Yeah. Okay. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
13, 1.
Okay. Greg continues with the next paper. Thank you. Of a single asset?
Yeah. So agenda paper 12E is about the sale of a single asset entity. In June, the committee discussed a submission about the sale of a single asset entity containing real estate. The submission asked about the accounting for a transaction in which an entity, as part of its ordinary activities, enters into a contract with a customer to sell real estate by selling its equity interest in a single asset entity that is a subsidiary. Paragraph 8 of the paper outlines the fact pattern in the submission. The committee did not reach a decision in June on how to proceed with this matter. In the light of the committee's discussion, we are asking the board for its views on possible narrow scope standard setting on this topic. We set out our view on how an entity applies IFRS standards in paragraphs 11 to 20 of the paper. Paragraphs 23 to 25 of the paper outline the committee's concerns by the application of the standards in the submission. We've considered two options open to the board. We describe a narrow scope standard setting project to address only the fact pattern in the submission in paragraphs 27 to 30 of the paper. And in paragraphs 31 to 40, the paper outlines some factors the board could consider as part of a broader project, either as part of the PIR of IFRS 10 or as part of your forthcoming agenda consultation. We recommend that the board consider this matter as part of the PIR of IFRS 10. This would allow you to obtain more evidence on the prevalence of the matter and, for example, whether any narrow scope standard setting in this respect might raise new questions or have unintended consequences. Do you agree with our recommendation?
Now we have an opportunity.
Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I agree with staff's recommendation. I think a couple of comments. First, I think this case, based on a very specific fact pattern, I'm not sure in reality that entity was established only have one real estate assets and some related tax assets and liability. For example, there are some human beings to take care of those assets. If they are human beings, they are liability to pay salary, wages, something else. So I think in reality, whether there is a really this kind of pure, you know, entity exists, if not, I think we should be careful to address this very specific pure fact pattern in this regard. Secondly, if we are going to require the entity to apply IFRS 15 rather than IFRS 10, because I think there is the intention of those entity created this specific entity hold those real estate assets and sell to the customer, sometimes for tax purpose or for other things. Now, if for accounting purpose, we say this is just holding the assets, sell assets to customer. The nature of the transaction will change because of the accounting standards, different accounting standards apply. I'm worried about that. Maybe there will be some unintended consequences. For example, we'll have some conflicts with local, you know, legal requirements, tax laws, something like that. So this is the second thing. Third thing is that we should be very careful, if not apply IFRS 10 rather than apply IFRS 15, it will create another exception for applying IFRS 10. I think it should be very, very careful because the objective of IFRS 10 is try to minimize the exception for consolidation's financial statement based on the uniform control. So in this case, I would like to not to address this issue at this moment, just leave this issue as a matter of the board's PIR of IFRS 10 to make sure whether this is really critical issue and very common, and then we decide the next step between the two.
Nick?
Thank you. So I find the situation quite perplexing, I have to say. And it seems to me from what's been written in the paper by the staff that our requirements are clear. And so I guess on the back of that I have three questions. One is whether there's any prospect of an agenda's decision from the committee, or whether that we don't think that's at all likely. Secondly, whether we have any evidence around user needs in this area, whether they have raised concerns about accounting. And my third question, you talk about two options in terms of where the board could move forward, one being some narrow standard setting, the other being putting this into the post-implementation review of IFRS 10. Is a third option a board agenda decision to confirm existing requirements? That's not possible.
Maybe I'll start at the end and work backwards. So your last suggestion, a board agenda, is not possible at this stage because there's no such thing at the moment. It's a proposal in the due process handbook review, but mm-hmm. not yet finalised. In terms of, sorry, I can't remember question two.
User needs, and if we heard anything of concerns from users.
So we haven't heard any investor user concerns about this. In saying that, the outreach that we had is that they're probably not aware is that I think a lot of people are already applying IFRS 15 to these types of transactions, although we heard, mm-hmm. you know, we heard in our outreach a mixture. Some mm-hmm. are applying IFRS 10, some are applying IFRS 15, but no, we haven't directly heard any.
A comment on the committee.
True, yeah.
Maybe I'll comment on the situation with the committee, which was very difficult. The committee, from memory, agreed with the technical analysis. So they agreed with what the staff's analysis is, which is that it's clearly within the scope of IFRS 10, and that the requirement, because there is control of an entity, is that you recognise a single gain or loss on disposal. However, the committee, many of the committee members don't really think that's useful information. And so they were keen, I think, to hear the board's view on this before the committee decided what it wanted to do. So it's one of those tricky situations where it's clear, but there might be some anxiety around the outcome.
Rika.
I support staff's position, because I truly think the decision over the scope of the which standard should be applied in a specific transaction is very important, and then also the requirement around the IFRS 15's scope exclusion is a very fundamental part of IFRS 15. So the narrow scope exception might distort proper application in practice, because that might invite structured transactions as unintended consequences. So I thought without knowing the pervasiveness of this issue, I don't think we proceed to get a targeted narrow scope amendment at this moment.
Ms. Raza.
Well, I certainly share the discomfort of the interpretation committee members as to concluding that IFRS 10 should apply the way it's meant to apply based on the analysis. And I also agree with the analysis, but I think it's one of these situations where if you look at the things bluntly, you would end up with requiring information which is not, which in fact doesn't have the qualitative characteristics in the framework. Mm. Because, I mean, portraying a revenue-generating activity differently from having revenue and the cost of sales, to me, is just not possible. So I would rule out, having an agenda decision that says, the standards are clear, and basically you have just a net proceeds to show somewhere in your income statement. To me, and if I was in that situation and a preparer, I guess I would want to call on IS1 and depart from IFRS. And I don't think we want to lead people doing that once a problem has been identified. So now, as to what to do next, personally, I thought of the issue and didn't have enough elements in order to think. I was, in fact, wondering whether the conditions of transfer of control were really met, because if you have basically an asset under construction, and the way this construction develops is, in fact, determined in the contract between the two parties, the new owner, because basically this is becoming the legal owner of the asset under construction, I'm not sure that party is in a different position from the position of another customer that buys the same asset in the same conditions, in the same circumstances, except that there is no legal vehicle there. So I didn't have enough elements out of the paper, but I would be willing, in fact, to get into a greater analysis of where, we have all the voting rights, fine, but is there any substance for these voting rights to be exercised? Because if a change in the construction design has to be made, I mean, it needs to be made through a revised contract, a modification to the contract. So what is really the substance of the transfer of control in a situation when basically you have this transfer of control progressively as IFRS 15 describes it? So I don't think we can allow this to end up as the standards are clear. even though they are. But I would recommend further analysis into what is this animal that we're facing in these circumstances.
If it's helpful, Françoise, I'll just clarify a couple of points on that. One is, you know, as I think Jin Chao described, we were presented with you know, a very narrow fact pattern. And part of the facts that we were given and we ensured when we spoke to the submitter, we said, these are facts, was that the real estate entity itself had already decided it controlled the subsidiary, and therefore, you know, because the subsidiary was set up and established some time before it entered, you know, it even found a customer to buy the real estate. So part of the embedded facts that we didn't analyse, you know, was that the real estate entity already decided it controlled the subsidiary and it was applying IFRS 10 to it. So it's only to explain that was an embedded part of the facts that we didn't analyse. I suppose the other thing that I think, you know, you bring up that obviously is a point is that if you're applying IFRS 15, of course, you have the question about the timing of transfer of control. Again, we didn't get into this. We assume at some point, which could be over time or point in time, control is transferred. But again, we didn't get into that level of analysis because it wasn't sort of part of the question. We were asked to talk about the exact timing of transfer of control.
I really think that we don't have enough elements. And your paper says that, you know, it's either before, during, or after construction. So, I mean, you have a variety of situations there that do not necessarily call for the same answer. Mm-hmm. So,
Anne?
Thanks, Hans. I don't agree with the staff recommendation to take this to the PIR. I don't think that's the right way to do this. It's come to us to consider narrow scope standard setting because of the situation the committee found themselves in their discussions, and Sue's outlined that. And then we've heard from various people around the table. It's a very narrow set of circumstances, and there are some complicated elements to it, and I think it needs to be considered by the board separately. I don't think you can just put it into the PIR because of the structure of the PIR, where stakeholders are already telling us to set up this PIR, the request for information, with broad questions to go out and consider how these things are working in practice. It's a very different approach to what we need to do for this one. I can't envisage a document that it seeks feedback at a high level and then somewhere down the bottom says, oh, and in these specific circumstances, what do you think about this? And if I was on the outside and I got this document, I think, oh, how strange. And why have they chosen to elevate this one when the staff could find 20 specifics if they wanted to go that way? So in terms of process, I'm just not sure that putting it into the PIR is the way that we should deal with it. I know we've got issues, and you raise them in the paper, about prioritisation and whether this should queue jump a lot of other issues. But I think it's very specific. I think some very important questions are in there, and I think that would be delayed and lost in a PIR process. So I don't support it.
I think this is a good illustration of the complexity of the relationship between the committee and the board, apart from anything else, because we're quite strict with the committee, at least I am, in terms of trying to remind them that their role is really to comment on the application of the standards as issued by the board, and they've done that and concluded that it is that the requirements would result in the outcome that the staff has set out in the paper, but they're then flagging to us a question about whether we think it's useful information or not. And so I think that's the appropriate route. I don't think it's really the route of the committee to tell us they don't like our standards per se, although it's useful to know what their thoughts are on the usefulness of the information for the board to then consider. So I think this is tricky, but a good discipline between the two organisations. In terms of the staff recommendation, I have to say I'm really quite torn on this because I think it would be inappropriate for us, in a sense, to be seen to be stubborn and say, well, that's what the words say, therefore just, you know, we're going to ram it down your throats by issuing an agenda decision, and I think we need to be careful to avoid the perception that that's what we're trying to do. On the other hand, I'm not sure. And if we do, and so I do have sympathy for thinking about doing something narrow scope if we can do it narrow scope. But I think the challenge with this is, and I think Françoise illustrated it quite well herself, that it may not be as straightforward as what it seems on the surface, because I don't think it's incorrect to say that because I've sold control of a company that you should apply IFRS 10 and recognise a gain or loss on disposal, because there's probably some point between I just own a building and it's just a very passive ownership and I sell the company that just owns that building versus I've now got a few staff members, I've got a construction project. We'll all probably fall off at some point in time in a different view of when it's appropriate to recognise that as a revenue-type transaction versus the sale of the business transaction. And also I think we're sort of starting with the simplistic assumption that I would conclude that it is a sale under 10 and it would also be a sale under 15, and those two things may not line up, which was I hadn't thought about until Françoise flagged it. So I'm not sure it's going to be so straightforward to deal with it. Having said that, I can see why in the sort of very black and white cases it seems like an odd outcome that all I have done is sold a building, and because I put it in a corporate wrapper I get very different presentation in profit or loss. So I wonder whether we need to do a little bit more investigation in terms of whether we can really keep it narrow scope, and also the usefulness of information aspect, which I think that Nick flagged. I think kicking the can down the road to the PIR maybe is not the best thing to do.
Especially not if it would mean in the meantime that we issue an agenda decision.
Well, it could mean two things. Either we issue an agenda decision and people are unhappy with the accounting that results from it, or we don't issue an agenda decision at all, which means we know that there's going to be diversity in application, and neither of those are fantastic outcomes. Yeah.
I mean,
it's difficult.
Yeah.
Well, especially the first one, I wouldn't like.
Yeah, but also we have to be careful, though, and I do agree, but we can't have a situation where people don't like the answers of applying our standards, that you can somehow pretend that's not the answer just because you haven't issued an agenda decision. It's tricky.
And just for clarity, by the way, I wasn't disagreeing with your comments at all on control. I agree that control can transfer at different points. My point I was only going to make, and if it's helpful to the conversation about if the board were to do something, how would we do it? I think part of our thinking that's kind of set out in paragraph 28 that talks about if the board would like to do something, why we would suggest moving it incredibly narrowly along these lines, is to try and avoid getting into all those discussions about what's the exact point of transfer of control, because at least our initial thinking is if you were to do something here, let's just keep it at changing the scope of the standards in a sense. So simply saying, if you've got a transaction that meets all of these characteristics, before you would have been in 10, now you're in 15, so that we don't override or get into a lot of complication about starting to, specify exact points in time when you transfer control, because that's already addressed either in IFRS 10 and in IFRS 15. So it was more to keep it simple in a sense. We thought, let's just avoid talking about that. This would simply, if the board were to do what we were thinking about, it would simply be to lift it out of the scope of one standard and put it into the scope of another.
Chung-Wu.
Thank you. I think, I agree with Dr. Anne's comment, that maybe we need to choose another approach, the narrow scope amendment, because, based on this, your good analysis, already the majority committee members are interpreting the standard that you have to apply the IFRS 10 rather than IFRS 15 now. So they have made a concern. In that case, there is no revenue presented in their financial statement. So that's a very absurd situation. So as Patricia, said in the beginning, in current practices, they're using the IFRS 15, and the US GAAP is using the IFRS 15 on this kind of a pure form, maybe not complicated one. So what I'm saying is, another thing is, if we delay the PIR of the as a PIR of the IFRS 10, it will take a lot of time, many years later. But still, already there is some kind of a different practice that the interpretation committee decided on the IFRS 10 you have to apply. But there is a lot of big confusion in the practice, so I guess we need to be a little hurry up to finish this kind of a diversity, because we had showed a kind of a direction on this accounting. So I totally agree with Anne's suggestion. Yeah.
Martin.
I mean, I'm not sure if it would be an easy to handle narrow scope project, because what we're discussing here is a structured transaction. And then the question is, okay, my understanding is from the interpretation committee the answer was clear, but they don't like the outcome. And that's really the question. And maybe many people think, okay, if you're doing structured transaction, you want to achieve, because the structure is in this example was, okay, this is a sale of a legal entity, because you don't have to send to pay different taxes. That was their intent. Mm-hmm. But then from the accounting perspective, maybe some want to see it as a kind of normal revenue, and different taxes has to be applied. And I don't know if we can easily answer that in this kind of example and not discussing the overall issue then. And because if you're looking in banking, a lot of structured transactions, and then the question is, would you account for this based on the substance or maybe the form, and what is the usefulness of this kind of information? So I would really maybe do, is there, agree with staff recommendation, is there a kind of issue with IFRS 10 and 15 in this regard, and do we have to do something? But I would think it is really not an easy to answer question.
Gary.
Listening to the discussion actually changed my going position this meeting, and actually I don't agree with the staff recommendation. I did an hour ago. As I step back and think about it, actually, I think 10 gives you a very clear answer, given the fact circumstances, but like some others, I'm sympathetic. Does that answer actually make any sense? I think if you put it to a PAR process, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think it's going to come back to you're doing narrow, 4 years from now, you're doing narrow scope standard setting. I just think that's the inevitable outcome of this. So if that's the case, why are we going to kick the can down the road 2, 3, 4 years by the time you go through the PRs of 10, 11, and 12, which is back to narrow scope standard setting? Now, as I'm reading in the first sentence on paragraph 1, it says the request was about a single asset entity containing real estate. Well, is the operative phrase single asset entity, or is it containing real estate? What if it contained a patent? And you just licensed your patent through a subsidiary and brought in revenues that way. There's all sorts of single asset entities in this world, whether they're SBEs, whether they're development, research or development entities, and so on. For whatever reason you want the corporate wrapper around it, I don't think you should get a different answer in the real estate, using real estate as an example. I transfer it back to the parent company, I sell it for revenue, or I leave it in the subsidiary, you get a net gain or loss, as the case may be. Those are very anomalous and, I think, dysfunctional type answers, depending on the structure. If we're going to do anything, I would start with narrow scope standards. So maybe perhaps research is basically you're recommending research via PIR, and maybe it's research, the more normal, research thing. But I just think you're going to be back to narrow scope standard setting, so why wait 3 years before you get to it?
Mary?
I think an unusual show of American unity on this one, because I came to the same outcome as Anne, but for different reasons. And I think my thinking may be a bit more aligned with Gary's. I think an important point in this paper is that the staff believes that in order to apply IFRS 15, we'd have to do an amendment to existing standards, rather than it's an interpretive question. And I for the timing reasons Gary cited, I think we should try and go ahead and do that, because I'm not brave enough to speculate about exactly when we would come back to narrow scope. It's just pointing out that it's two layers. It's first you complete the PIR and have the feedback statement and prioritize things in the feedback statement, and then you start doing standard setting. So it's a known issue. It's the relatively early days of IFRS 15, so I would be minded to try and address it. Thinking of Gary's point about does it have to be real estate, I think it doesn't. I think, you know, what you've highlighted is there's a very narrow set of circumstances that you are suggesting be addressed that's a single asset. It's not an operating company. And I think that that is a critical distinction. And then also the point about it being 100% owned before and selling 100% of the interest. Now, that I think, you know, Jing Zhao was expressing concern that that's a narrow set of fact patterns, a narrow set of facts, and therefore this might be a rare circumstance. But I think the range of fact patterns that raises this question is broad. The staff is proposing to create a narrow exception that would capture only some of them, you know, in what you sketched out as a narrow scope amendment. And I think if we're doing a narrow scope amendment, it makes sense that it's a narrow set of circumstances. And I think, you know, in terms of some of the concerns about the interaction between 10 and 15 that Francoise raised, I think because of the way you proposed designing it, which is take it out of the scope of 10 and say apply the 15 recognition criteria, you then would address, you duck having to provide lots of guidance. I think Martin's point was a good one about, Martin's concern is addressed because you weren't suggesting going down the route of saying based on the substance of the transaction, and that's much broader and has much greater applicability to any number of structured transactions. You're trying to define a narrow set of circumstances that are single asset, not operating company, 100%, you know, and say in these circumstances, apply 15. I think based on the information we had at the interpretation committee, I would not suggest doing a lot more research, with the potential exception of Nick's point about making sure we, before we invest in doing that, that we have some sense of what users think is useful information. If they share the concern about the usefulness of the no revenue in these fact patterns. So for those reasons, I'd say go ahead with the narrow scope standard setting rather than waiting for the PIR.
I take a different view. I think except if some we have already in-house more information that is contained in this paper, I think we need more research. Or more information went to the board. I'm not convinced that an narrow scope amendment is needed, because you know, I don't know, so I can't tell. But we've seen in a number of examples that various jurisdictions have different ways of setting up, you know, the legal framework about the transfer of construction in progress. And different ways in making that irrevocable, so that you, in fact, you transfer at some point in time. You find a way of transferring the legal ownership, and the transaction is, in fact, irrevocable, or whoever becomes the new owner has to sell the property against. And we see that there are a variety of legal frameworks that help achieve this outcome. So to me, it's very important that we get to the root of the issue, to see whether it's just one different legal form of a phenomenon that is already within the scope of IFS 15 without ambiguity.
But I don't understand, because I thought it was a really simple fact pattern, which was just, I've clearly got a company and I sell you all the shares with all of the voting rights. It just so happens that the company owns a building. And so it's clearly within the scope of IFRS 10, and there's clearly a transfer of control of the shares, the decision-making in that company. So it's clearly within the scope of 10 and therefore can't be in 15. And I thought it was just that simple fact pattern we were trying to deal with.
I'm not sure. I just don't have enough information
to the fact pattern that you were given?
And my concern is that we have also, as part of the result of the outreach, the fact that this exists in a number of jurisdictions. So you may have variations from jurisdiction. And it also applies with transfer of shares for less
than 100%. You may have a multiple customer circumstance. So I really think before saying we need, I think we need to do something, but I would need more information in order to make up my mind whether we need narrow-scope standard setting or whether we just need, in fact, a greater analysis of what we're facing. What is the substance that we're really facing?
Rika.
I mean, I do not change my position, I originally said, but I did not mean that it's necessary to put in a PIR of IFRS 10. This is a kind of the pervasiveness, is a scope issue between IFRS 10 and IFRS 15. So considering that, I share the idea of Wandsworth. We need to look into more about fact pattern, because people normally simplify the fact pattern when those stakeholders ask a question to IC. So I'm not sure this is a kind of the issue where we can take care within the scope of the targeted narrow scope standard setting.
I suppose if it's helpful, I'll just come back to at least what we know from the work that was done by the committee. So just to emphasise again, the fact pattern we are given is set out in paragraph 8 of the paper, and that's the basis on which the committee did its outreach as well. And those facts are, so I think it is an incredibly narrow fact pattern, but I think because of potentially mainly tax benefits, you know, that you can get tax benefits by putting an asset inside a corporate wrapper, that very narrow fact pattern does happen in different jurisdictions. And that very narrow fact pattern is one where a real estate company, for tax or other reasons, so it's in the business of constructing and selling real estate, It for whatever reason, puts any real estate that it sells inside a corporate wrapper structure. At some point, when it buys the land somewhere early in its process, it then constructs a building or whatever, and the way that it then enters into transactions with customers is it sells all its 100% ownership in the corporate wrapper structure in the entity to that customer. So that's the fact pattern, and it had already decided it controlled that entity that it set up, so it was already applying IFRS 10. So first of all, those are the facts. We weren't asked, we weren't given information about when control transfer doesn't transfer. It's assumed that whenever they sell all of the shares to the customer, at that point they lose control of the subsidiary as defined in IFRS 10. Now, so we did the outreach on that fact pattern and on that basis. Now, to your point, Rico, we don't know if everybody read exactly those facts or whether they expanded, but we assume at least the outreach responses that we got were based on, you know, observations and practice about that fact pattern. We did ask specifically in the outreach about where there's, you know, or how frequently it happened that there were situations that companies sold, you know, less than 100% of their ownership in entities, or how often was it that there were similar structures, but maybe the entity also had, for example, you know, operations in there or other assets or liabilities. And at least what the outreach said was, it's whilst it is common in a number of jurisdictions that for this narrow fact pattern to exist, they have seen some of the others, but it's much less common. So it's less common that, or it's not common, the words where it's not common that the people end up selling. You know, I think given the nature of the transaction, that they're selling less than 100%. So I suppose in terms of thinking about anything to do, I only explain that because that kind of led a bit to our thoughts that if the board wanted to do standard setting, what is a way that we could potentially target and resolve this for at least most, as far as based on what we know, we could provide a solution where we understand the majority, you know, that would cover the majority of the transactions that are happening, but in a way that could be very targeted, actually very rules-based, because it would be an exception. and therefore I think would be relatively manageable in a sense. I think that at least our thoughts, and we can do more, is if we start to expand our research into other situations, then this becomes actually even just doing the research becomes quite a big time commitment on our part and on stakeholders' part. So I just wanted to mention that in the context of your thinking. So what we're suggesting is if we want to do something, I think if we can keep it very targeted, very narrow and very rules-based, it's possible to do it quite efficiently and hopefully target and resolve where there are the majority of the questions that arose without getting into sort of making this a very big exercise.
Tom? Yeah. I want to kind of echo what Francoise said. I could go either way, but I'd be concerned. I think just even this notion, I think you used the term rules-based. Rules-based is always more efficient, but it causes problems in the long run, and I think that just we would need to know. And in this particular case, in the first sentence, it's interesting. It's the sale of a single asset entity, again, containing real estate, and Gary pointed out could be other stuff. But on the other side, when we get to paragraph 28, we have a very clear capital structure. It's 100% equity. Seems to me you could have single asset entities with different capital structures. I could have a major contractor with a subcontractor regularly carries 10%. They do some risk sharing. They cash in when the thing sells. And that kind of goes to what I think Francoise was saying, and I would like us to at least understand what's out there as opposed to a narrow rule for a very narrow thing. If we go that route, I'd like a standard that holds up the various things that could be out there, including the ones where, you know, why do they sell 90% and not 100% if they own? And I think those things should be clarified if we go down that route. Maybe we do make it narrow at the end, but I don't think we should make it narrow right immediately without checking out what those other things are.
Sue?
So a couple of things maybe on this notion of it being rules-based first and then secondly on the approach. I think we need to be careful not to get into a mindset where every time rules get mentioned at the table we think it's bad by definition. And I think that when we make exceptions to standards we always try to be as rules-based as possible because it's really important that it's clear when you're in the scope of one thing and when you're in the scope of the other. And I think the reason why the committee got this question and why the committee's reacted the way they do is that you get a really, really stark difference depending on whether you're in the scope of 10 or whether you're in the scope of 15 because you get this really different presentation in P&L. So it's really important to know which way that you go. At the moment, which way you go is determined on basically the whether or not there's a company involved or not. And we get hugely different outcomes all over the place in our accounting if there's corporates or not corporates. So the whole analysis of control, for example, is completely different if I stick an asset inside of a company or if I own an asset directly. If I have an option over an asset, I don't bring the asset on the balance sheet, but if I have an option over a company that owns the asset, I do. And this is just another manifestation of that. So I think we need to be realistic that if we're going to change the line from corporate versus not corporate to something else between 10 and 15, it's going to have to be a rule unless we're going to live with something like substance, which I think would be really difficult to bring in. So I don't think we should object just because it's a rule. I think there is a question about where we draw the line, so how we articulate the rule. I'd agree with that. But I think we need to be careful. The staff are being cautious and recommending we don't do standard setting because they're worried that we're going to boil the ocean as soon as we get given the question, and I think we're showing them that that's about what we're risking doing. That we got a really straightforward question that came to the committee. People are saying in this really straightforward fact pattern, it seems like there's hardly any difference between selling the building and selling the company. Can you not help us out? And I think the staff's proposal is to try not to just focus on real estate, to focus on inventory, to make it where there is, you know, a pretty simple fact pattern, 100% sale, and just deal with that clear case where I think it's most egregious potentially to people that there's such a big difference between applying 10 and 15. And I think if we do it that way, we've got a chance of doing it efficiently, dealing with the question that we got and getting it done, whereas otherwise we risk turning it into a project that really then does take up resources.
And then we might just as well wait for the PIR.
Yeah. So I think personally our choice is either suck it up and issue the agenda decision that basically says, yes, whether or not there's a corporate wrap, it does create a definite difference between 10 and 15, or do something narrow scope to address this. I think those are personally our two options.
Françoise?
Well, I think, you know, Petrina tells us we took the fact pattern starting with the analysis of control being done and the conclusion being reached that the control had passed. I would want to take the fact pattern a step back and see on what basis the transfer of control has been determined as having happened. So I would want to take this one step back. And I think if you take it one step back, you may find out that either it's just there were 100% voting rights, the transfer of control is done, and then the question is wide open, or you gather more facts, and that brings more into the analysis. Now, I didn't say that I was against narrow scope standard setting. If standard setting is required, that it cannot be just be an interpretation, I'm not against having a narrow scope amendment. I would be mindful of not making so restrictive that you take part of the transaction because that's the case where the majority happens, mm-hmm. and leave aside what is a significant minority of transactions that happen to be dealt in a very inconsistent manner, even though it's the same similar fact pattern that we are considering at the outset. So I would, you know, I would have that caution. And if we make an exception, we will have to motivate this exception. So in motivating an exception, you always bring some analysis. So it's not purely a rule. You explain the reasoning why the exception is needed in order to have useful information as an outcome. That in itself is not a rule.
Well, I think we have to come to a...
Okay.
Oh, Nick.
So it seems to me, building on what Martin said, that the economics of these transactions are different, clearly, whether it's sort of a single asset or with of an entity, because it has to be, because why other would you put it in a wrapper? So there is something different going on here. We have to acknowledge that. And that makes me worry that this may not be a narrow scope amendment. This may balloon out. I think there may be some more work to do in this particular circumstance to understand whether the value driver to these transactions is the construction element or the real estate element. If it's the real estate element, people are focused on the net asset value and not on the revenue line of these transactions. So I'd like to explore if there's any area for explanation. I think that's something that's worth thinking about. But I also see that there are many requests from stakeholders which are regarded as pressing in terms of our resources, and our resources are limited. In this case, our requirements are clear as they stand today. I don't think there's any dispute over that. And so, personally, I'd be more inclined to think of this as being an agenda consultation issue rather than a PIR or a narrow scope. Compete with everything else people want us to put our attention to.
Sue?
I think that I would agree with you usually. I think the only thing that makes me hesitate here is because a question came into the Interpretation Committee, if we don't do anything, I think we risk sending a message to the market that they can decide when to apply 15 and 10.
Martin?
And I would, as Sue said, the agenda decisions, the standard is clear. And the overall problem, and if the company is doing structuring opportunities to get an outcome, there is substance in it, because otherwise tax would not follow that in this regard. Then the question is for us, okay, do we overcome that? Do we think it is more useful if we're ignoring that? But if we want to discuss all that, that is more an agenda consultation thing, and it is kind of a broader project. I think we cannot solve that in looking at one only example, but not using the broader context. So I would, in this regard, I would do an agenda decision and would ask people, okay, do you have really interest in answering the overall question, okay, if people doing structuring stuff, okay, should we then have rules?
Yeah.
I guess I would.
So, well, let's see what the staff recommendation does. Does it get sufficient support? No. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation, which is to leave it to the PIR?
One.
Actually, yeah. Actually, I think there's a separate question. First, whether we agree with the narrow scope amendment. If not, then other.
But then,
what's the next step? But I think this is the first. Yeah.
But then, really, a narrow scope amendment. Do we want that?
Not yet.
Or
it's not a question.
Or the third alternative is to leave it.
Just
leave it and pick it up during the agenda consultation.
Okay, so what are you going to try next?
Why don't we ask for more analysis first before making a decision?
Who would like to explore a narrow scope amendment, but then the staff should be able to figure out quickly that it indeed can.
So we'll, along the lines of what's in paragraph 28 in the paper.
Who supports that?
I don't like the 28C. Why would you limit it to inventories? There's all sorts of other property in the world that inventories in real estate.
Yeah, but by definition, Gareth, if the whole purpose of this is for people to get revenue, surely it's got to be something they're holding for sale in the ordinary course of business.
Or license, if you're a patent, it was my example earlier.
And that would, if that is your business, to sell patents, then that would be inventory for you, so that wouldn't be excluded from inventory.
Wouldn't be inventory if you're licensing.
Yeah.
So inventory is any asset. By the way, inventory can be both tangible items and intangible items, and it's anything that you hold for sale in the ordinary course of business.
But you're back to the question of a patent might not even be on your balance sheet. You know, it was developed, through R&D, and it's just zero on the balance sheet for it, but just still, you have the rights to it, you put it in there. What if you had a right-to-use asset, under 16, I'm okay in the first two. It's really just the limiting of to IS2 and inventories or ag products or pipelines. There's all sorts of single-use assets that exist in the world. If you want to say they're part of inventories, I might doubt, but there is a lot of narrow assets that can be sit inside corporate wrappers.
I'm a bit worried about, yes. The different views that we have in the board around the scope, so yeah. I don't think it will work.
No. I think we need more information. Why don't we have just to take a run?
Yeah, but that is all, that is also work.
Right.
And do we want to invest staff time in this, or do we leave things as they are and leave it either to the PIR or to an agenda consultation? That's the question.
I think we need to try and see if we've got enough support for something along the lines of what the staff has set out in terms of proposed scope.
Can I just ask, a couple of people have said that they would prefer that an agenda decision was issued on 10 that said this is the committee has looked at it.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, is that an option of the board to say we would like the committee?
We can't make the committee issue an agenda decision. But I think that if we're not going to do standard setting,
the expectation should be
that an agenda decision will be published.
Okay.
Because we can't create an environment where we suggest that just because agenda decisions, that you can bless non-application of our requirements by avoiding agenda decisions.
Yeah.
Well, I think if we're going to push this down the road through a PIR, through further research, through agenda consultation, we could inform the interpretation. That's our decision. The ball is in their court. Do they think they need an answer now?
Yeah,
and if they don't think you need an answer now, well, then that validates the reason to do longer-term research.
Well, ultimately, the question that we ask the committee is whether there's sufficient guidance to know what to do, and that's what the agenda decision sets out.
I mean, to safeguard the position of the agenda decisions, it should not become like a tool to avoid unpleasant questions. So, Françoise?
I'm ready to vote in favour of narrow scope standard setting because I guess that's with more analysis that's where we would be heading. But I would not want to be voting to die on the scope. And so I would want the work to go ahead, but with a supplementary step of the staff of looking into more elements of the facts and circumstances that we... And eventually you get to a different recommendation in terms of scope and what to do.
Along the lines of what was set up.
We take the, along the lines
of... But as soon as the staff gets the idea, we might not be able to contain this, then it has to come back. And then we can call it quits. Yeah?
I mean, it's effectively like a research project where you see if there's possible solutions and what the problem definition is, and then you come back to the board to see if you can move it to standard setting.
Yeah, and we just need to be careful and cap the amount of research because of all, if you just listen to the discussion today, when we get into corporate versus non-corporate, when you get into less than 50, you know, other, this could become enormous and we could spend all of our time for the next year on it, but I think we need to keep it very manageable unless my team stops all of its other work.
And come back quickly and, you know, give us a stark choice.
We'll make sure we've got enough votes for that route.
Let's
six, seven, eight.
That's enough. Eight items for 30. Well, that's why I want to start not to invest too much time in this. Come up with a proposal. All right. Next. The update. Yes. Then we'll take a break.
We will move on to the quick update, Agenda Paper 12F, which summarizes the committee's September meeting. The committee finalized six agenda decisions. Those agenda decisions begin on page 8 and were finalized largely as exposed. Because we have discussed these final agenda decisions with you previously, I'm not intending to spend any time discussing those at this meeting unless you have specific questions. What I will do briefly is just talk about some of the tentative agenda decisions, which start on page 2. As you will see, the committee published 5 tentative agenda decisions. The first tentative decision relates to cost incurred to fulfill a contract with a customer. It was, in fact, a question about whether to apply the requirements in IS 38 or IFRS 15 to those costs. And in this fact pattern, the committee concluded that the entity applies IS 38. Now, the next tentative agenda decision relates to assessing whether applying IFRS 16, a contract contains a lease. In this fact pattern, many, but not all of the relevant activities, all of the relevant decisions, sorry, about how and for what purpose the asset is used are predetermined. Now, when the committee looked at it, they concluded that the contract nonetheless contains a lease because the customer retains some of the relevant decision-making rights. And moving on to the next 3 tentative agenda decisions, they all relate to the restatement and translation of results and financial position of hyperinflationary foreign operations. These decisions deal more with the interaction of the requirements in IAS 21 on foreign exchange and on IAS 29 on accounting for hyperinflation. And these questions came to the committee as a result of Argentina becoming hyperinflationary in 2018. So with that, I will just stop here and ask if you have any questions on any of the tentative agenda decisions or on any other matter included in the IFRIC update.
Harry?
A comment rather than a question, and it's on the definition of a lease, Agenda Paper 3. I just actually wanted to commend the staff on doing a great job of bringing out a point that came out of the discussions at the Interpretation Committee that I thought was very helpful to analyzing these difficult circumstances in which you have a lot but not all of the decisions predetermined. And the work that you've done to bring out the distinction between within the scope, I might not be using exactly the right word, within the scope of its right of use, is I think very, very helpful. So, and that was something that really helped the committee. So I think that this is, I hope it will be very useful going forward.
Any other comments? No? Then it's time for lunch. Convene at 1:15. Okay.